utilized for more busing for the purpose of racial balance.
I don't know if that answers your question better, but school districts can go off and they could, or do the plans and so forth and so on. ATW be there to help.
Most of these volunteer plans have been ATW inspired.
Wait a minute, that's my line.
Mr. President, one thing I would hope is that the judiciary committee of the House and the Senate would work immediately on the moratorium, right, and not assume that the conference is going to take care of it and therefore do nothing for a month. Because we're going to do the best we possibly can, and I think we can, but it's going to be helpful to have the expertise of the judiciary committee, and if we don't get it done, I think that it would be terrible if you had this month delay waiting for the conference.
Mr. President, I want to call attention to one thing. We were speaking about the constitutional amendment. Yeah. Constitutional amendment could be added in the Senate as an amendment to a resolution proposing a constitutional amendment. And the donor require more than a majority vote to add it to another amendment. For example, the Equal Rights for Women amendment is up. It will, of course, require two votes. You can add an amendment. Bringing about a constitution and all that,
people couldn't vote against women, they have to vote for other people.
I don't have to say anything.
That's a good way to get a vote.
Mr. President, I want to put you referred in your opening remarks. You drew attention to what the original problem of the Board of Education was concerned with. And here we find the application of that in this place down. The idea that we start finding bad situations with reference to racial, with reference to racial balance or whatever. It prescribes a remedy which is worse in terms of quality education, which is the objective of education. Now then, where is the objective? And the objective of Brown, and the objective of Brown. Now, where in all of this do we run to work? Is this proposition dealt with? That when busing is of such distance or duration that educative efforts or safety or health of the child is jeopardized or so badly impaired that it is a worse remedy than the sufferance of what now exists. Where does this deal with that situation?
We're going to be asked that question.
John, I'm going to be asked that question.
I think what the President is proposing here is that the Congress declares, as a matter of public policy, that no child, kindergarten through sixth grade, should be transported for those purposes to flat. And then only only older children in those circumstances where no other conceivable remedy reaches the wrong. So that it's a distant remedy of last resort, and that's a statement of public policy going, I think, to the problem that you can get.
To the help of our legislation.
Now, is it further provision, excuse me, but
yeah,
in section 403C of the legislation says, no court, department, or agency of the United States shall require the transportation of any student if such transportation exposes the risk to the health of such student or constitutes a significant impediment on the educational process with respect to such student.
I see that in ordinary writing. I see that there, and I give it its full intention, but I refer to section B on page 2 at the bottom of the page, and that defines denial of equal educational opportunity. And I submit that without something in that there to say a child who is transported undue distances and for an undue time is being denied equal, that isn't it listed in that?
Well, it's part of the definition.
Mr. Mayor, I think the draftsman felt that if you read the statute as a whole, that would be the necessary result. There isn't anything to keep you from repeating it in there and in other places. But let me take the four corners of the statute. I believe that you end up where you're at. I think Roman Russ's point is well taken in terms of what it says.
But let's look at the statute as a whole and how we have to come here. The statute is as a whole, busing is not allowed at all for children 6th grade below. That it is
It is as a last resort, and then only in temporary for people above, in order to deal with the issue. The whole assumption of the statute is that busing is injurious to quality education. That's the whole assumption of the statute. And your point is it's not written in there, but I think we wouldn't have that. I mean, you wouldn't kick the busing thing if we knew that, unless the assumption was this is an education act, and then we say busing will be used only as a last resort, and then only the above the sixth grade, and then only as a temporary nature. Now, why is all that done? It's because, certainly, our conviction, mine at least, and I'm sure the others, are, that in case after case, we find that busing, based on this right, it leads to busing in and of itself, leads to inferior rather than superior education. It's an injurious education.
So, Mr. Collier, you have a point. I'd like to say this. A critical direct set of whoever is responsible, like 50 of these copies available for me. This is Friday, and I want this to come out about 2 minutes, so they will have it.
Which one is that?
I guess it's a trust in your...
John, they've been going on over superiority.
And it's like, I believe that.
They're probably negotiating for the purpose of, not of, assuring that rather than for any other purpose.
I think they have used them for that.
Henry?
The president, the verification panel has been meeting, three times in the last 10 days. Review the various issues installed. Some of which are extremely technical, and which we will present in the form of memoranda as they come up in the negotiation. But we thought we would present to you three major ones at this time, perhaps one other. The ABM level, the intuitive submarine launch missiles in the agreement, the duration of the agreement, which is really tied to the scope of the offensive limitation, and perhaps a word on a decision we may have to make in April on other space, large space terrain, radar, of which no decision is needed now, but in which we could perhaps put out what decision may become necessary. With respect to ATM levels, our current proposal is for two ATM sites, 100 interceptors, protecting ICBM fields. For one side, 100 interceptors protecting the capital, with each side having the right to choose. We obviously would choose the two sites because this in fact reflects our existing program and practical. The intent of our proposal is to treat both sides as where they are, or as what they're building. The Soviets are building the Moscow system on our 12 sites. We are building at Grand Forks and at Malmstrom. Malmstrom is at a very early stage of building. The delegation has concluded that the 2-for-1 proposal is probably not negotiable. The Soviets have proposed that we can keep one ICBM site. They would keep Moscow, and they would want one ICBM site in addition. So they have proposed 2-for-1 in reverse.
It's not negotiable.
And they have indicated that they think that the 2-for-2 arrangement might be acceptable if we wanted to have a site in Washington. Now this then breaks down into six possible proposals that could be made, but rather than submit to you these technical proposals, we have grouped them into three major categories, each of which has a variation. The categories are essentially as follows. One is the stuff each side measures, which in effect means Grand Forks for Moscow. Second is to allow each side a limited ICBM defense, which would mean that the Soviet Union would get Moscow and one ICBM field east of the Urals. We would get either two safeguard sites or one safeguard site in Washington. The third is a proposal that the Department of Defense has developed over recent months, which would be to permit each side what is called a hard side defense of ICBM sites, which means in effect radar and missiles specifically designed for the defense of ICBM sites. So they discuss each of these in turn with some of the pros and cons for each. If each site stops where it is, that reduces the concern that the Soviets may be developing a radar net which may give them area coverage later on for population defense. Secondly, it makes it easier, if that would be your decision, to move from there to a proposal of a zero ABM. We would have to stop construction at Malmstrom. The Soviets would have to stop nothing. In fact, they could continue building up to the permitted interceptor level. And
committee and employment and serve the following purposes. One, operation of experience. Two, as a base for expansion. Three, to prevent accidents. And four, to prevent limited attacks. I think in fairness, one would have to say that the Moscow system is better suited for more of these purposes than the Grand Fork system would be. In terms of operational experience, there would probably be little to choose from. As a base for expansion, the Grand Fork system suffers from the fact that probably we designed the defensive missile fields, we would design something different than the safeguard system, whose original purpose was, if you remember, area defense against third countries. It's difficult with the safeguard system, as with the Moscow system, is that it has a small number of radars, and that the number of radars controls the utility of the system. An enemy overwhelms the radar, the defense would be defeated. Therefore, one has to count the aiming points of the radars. Therefore, if one wanted to defend an ICBM field, one would want more radars and much fewer missiles per radar. Now, the Soviets, depending on population, are not exactly under this constraint. Now, with respect to accidents and limited attack, one is probably less worried about an accidental attack on a missile field than on anything else. And as far as a limited attack is concerned, an enemy would be insane to launch a limited attack on a missile field. And if you wanted to launch a limited attack on a missile field, you would have to compound his insanity by attacking the one defended missile field among the six we had. So I think the primary use of Grand Forks to us would be operational experience and would have almost no strategic utility, while the Soviet deployment would have the utility not against us, but through the Sessionism as into the ages of defense against a Chinese attack and maybe a French and British attack. This is not decisive, but it is a factor to be considered. One for one is probably the most easily negotiable. It does not put us at a disadvantage vis-a-vis the Soviets in the bilateral strategic relationship. A variation of this is to adapt the Soviet proposal and have a two-for-two arrangement, which we could do in one of two variations, either taking two missile sites for ours or asking that our second site be made Washington rather than Malmstrom. This would sacrifice, I think, about $100 million of investment in Malmstrom. We can move the other equipment into Washington.
We take all the equipment, yeah.
Yeah. We lose $100
million.
I think the investment is $200
million. So it's $46 million if the decision was made between now and the end of May. Sacrifice $46 million.
Of course, whether you decide to, if you were to go for a 2-for-2 system, whether you go for NCA rather than Malmstrom would depend in part on the judgment that you and your advisors make on whether Congress would in fact authorize the defense of Washington. Because if it failed, we would have in practice accepted the Soviet proposal 2-for-1. We asked for Washington, can't get it. We'd be back at the Soviet proposal, which we are, which you never indicated we will not accept. So, and Malmstrom is authorized, isn't it?
Malmstrom is authorized. So it is authorized.
We do with that if we want to do.
But under the Sentinel system, Washington is authorized, but we have not used the Sentinel authorizations. We are proposing to come back for an authorization.
Again, one would think perhaps better that a symmetrical arrangement is easier to negotiate. Washington and an ICBM site for Moscow and an ICBM site. Another problem with the one-for-one agreement that I've mentioned is technical arrangement. arrangement of the grouping of radars, which makes it very easy to defeat them, because we didn't want the Soviets to build up a population defense, and that is, all radar have to be grouped into a circle of, what is it, 3 kilometers before hitting point. Now, if this arrangement, however, were to be adopted for the missile defense side also, it would make the defense, it would make an attack on the missile side by major enemies really extremely easy. Now, if one went for a, and the Soviets have already pointed out that they would propose a different arrangement of radars, and presumably, if we were, we would ask for a different arrangement of radars at least one of those sides, and we could therefore have a base that permits an evolution of defensive concept, that is now the case under the restrictions which we are imposing in order to prevent the population defense of Moscow against a major attack. On the other hand, that an arrangement of radars that will merge into a hard side concept, which I'm going to explain in a minute. That is to say, that's at the missile field, or will be so resistant to qualitative controls that the practical defense consequence of agreeing to a limited ICBM defense may be that the whole exercise lies into a rather massive deployment of radar and launch. In other words, if you will opt for the middle option, that is to say, 2 for 2, some variation of 2 for 2, the delegation would have to be instructed to see rather strict on radar and on launch, and rather strict numerical limitations, even if the Mach concept is a ban. Now the Stuart proposal, this is a proposal that is being put by OSD, and that too has two variations, but I think if you accept the principle of any one of these, we can then come back to you with a specific technical proposal. That proposal in effect is that the present, it is based on the assumption that the present ICBM defense is not militarily very sensible. It has too few radars, too few interceptors, and is too easily overwhelmed by the terminal attack. Therefore, and it has the additional disadvantage that the radars and missiles also can be used for area defense, so that to an enemy it may look like the beginning of an area defense. It's too little for an area defense and too inadequate for ICBM defense. So the proposal that was developed by OSD in effect says that we should have a substantially unlimited number of radars and unlimited number of interceptors at the permitted missile fields, but that those radars and interceptors would be of the type that lends itself only to the defense of missile sites and not to area defense. They would permit as many as 1,000 interceptors at these missile fields, and I don't know no constraints on radars either.
Just one.
Just qualitative constraints on radar. This raises both strategic and political issues. Strategically, there is a debate as to how many additional Minutemen would actually be saved by such a hostile defense, and disputed down to. The second issue that it raises is that the practical result of such a scheme would be that what is advertised as a solid agreement actually permits more interceptors and radars than were ever part of any original ABM agreement, so that cosmetically it would have a really a
a building up. Create the impression that we're building up the defenses. But it's not as I say, interjected that point on. I had to make a decision on the political side. And let's have no nonsense, the real problem politically, except for a few nuts around here in this town, it's not going to be whether or not this is an agreement which lets the United States do more. The real problem politically is whether it is an agreement which limits us and lets the Soviet Union go ahead and get superiority. That's going to be the difficulty. Let's get that damn clear. As far as we're concerned, we want to make an agreement that will let us do just as much as we possibly can. They're out to screw us, and we've got to screw them. And that's the attitude we should have throughout these things, because I can see the political arguments already developing here on the SALT agreement. I know that if you read the papers here and the rest, you think it'll everybody just panic. We could only get a SALT agreement, and then the world's going to be safer and all the rest. That's fine. So if we want one, we hope we can get one, because it'll limit them and limit us in certain areas and so forth. But when the political arguments are made, believe me, the critics that will have the most effect are not going to be those that say, oh, gee, isn't it too bad? The United States didn't tie its hands as much as it should have. The political argument will be, you guys got taken. You tied your hands and you didn't tie theirs enough. So let's just get that right out of the ball game right away. So that's the good argument. I'm trying to present both sides. Everyone agrees that from if you wanted to defend the missile fields, the hard side defense is better than the safeguard defense. I don't think there's any disagreement on that. The disagreement concerns what the long-range strategic utility of it is by the time you attack it, which will be in the late 70s or early 80s, as against the threats of the 70s, late 70s and 80s. Secondly, the point I've just made, and thirdly, the question of whether this is in fact negotiable at this late stage of the discussions. There seems to be some dispute within the delegation whether the Soviets really understand that the missiles and radars would in fact be unconstrained.
They understand.
Well, you never formally made the proposal, but there has been only a smaller system today,
you understand. That's a good line. Of course, they're going to tell us they don't understand.
They understand. The question is,
do we understand what they want?
But those are obviously categories of decisions. One is whether we will have one-for-one. Second is whether we have a limited ICBM defense. Which would then get us into some variation of 2-for-1 and 2-for-2. And the third is whether we want to shift the whole concept of the defense, at least for one of the sides, into a hard side mode. Those are the three. Let me hear a little more argument on the hard side thing. I know it was discussed before, and we sort of rejected it, not on the hand, but on the ground, that, well, it would be hard to go to the Congress to get anything on this. What I think is fatuous ground that we have a SALT agreement that lets the United States do more, that everybody in this country is going to throw up their hands and say that's terrible because the United States is not to be trusted with power. But let's hear about the hard side. Who can give a man? I'd rather tell about the argument.
I'll make a few comments.
I don't know whether it's negotiable, but I'd like to know what the argument is.
First, about where we are on it in the United States, our problems with the Congress as far as getting it approved and so forth. Mr. President, the 12-side safeguard program, which you approved and which we are supporting in the Congress on a phased basis, is a very viable program, and it does meet the three criteria that you wanted us to meet. We had that, and I am still defending the 12-side program before the Congress, although we have done a phased basis, several sites a year. We have 4 sites presently approved, and we're going forward with the program to do the site survey work here in the Washington area. That is before the Congress at the present time. That program makes sense if you have 12 sites. It makes the knows that if you have two or four sites, it cannot be justified on a strategic basis at all, because it is...
It makes no sense if you just defend Washington.
Right. Makes no sense at all. Now, because we wanted, we felt that we would be in a position where we might have to cut down on the sites in the program. We have a follow-on program which is called, it's a point defense system called HARTSET. We're changing that name merely because some members of Congress have gotten the idea that that has something to do with hardening of the missiles. It has nothing to do with hardening of the missiles. It has to do with point defense system. Last year, we went to the Congress asking for money for HARTSET. And the Congress gave us the money. We have recently let the contract just 2 weeks ago with full knowledge and support of the Congress to go forward with the development of this particular defense system. This defense system gives you a small section that can be defended against a major threat and a major missile firing by the Soviet Union. It does not give you any of the area coverage that the 12-site system gives you. We will have less trouble getting HARTSET approved in the Congress than we would have getting this 12-site program approved. We will have great trouble supporting a 4-site program or a 2-site program if it is geared to the safeguard philosophy, however, because the safeguard philosophy just doesn't make any sense unless you have all 12 sites. Mr. President, I feel that this option should be maintained and should be open for us. If we cut down on the number of sites, we should have this option to improve the system so that it means something strategically. Any other system at one or two sites that does not preserve this option for the United States does not give us anything in the strategic area. I'm just briefly trying to...
President, I'm you can take it if I can, be sure. You say that the 12-site one makes sense, two makes no sense.
The safeguard system. Safeguard system, two sites makes no sense.
Yeah, no, sir, I just wanted to say that the Georgia staff feel very strongly that we should retain the option to conduct the NCAAP in Washington. We feel that way because we feel that the should we have a change highlighted that we would not go first. In other words, we feel it's imperative that the decision-making process be protected. And consequently, we would urge that any agreement relative to the ABM systems provide for the defense of the decision-making process. Here in Washington, I think the Soviets tend to try to feel the same way because they have maximized their effort towards Moscow from the outset. But if we're going to go second, in other words, if we're going to react to an attack, you need maximum time to move out where you are in a position to make the necessary decisions and so on.
It isn't so much that you have the time, Mr. President, because I don't think this is going to take place. But it's the idea that the other side knows one who has that capability. My problem is out of here.
Why is it wrong before we have that?
Well, that gives credibility to your deterrent, but I hope it never has to be used. That isn't the point of having that.
Why? Just by your influence.
No. It is to, it's the cheapest way to give realism to your deterrent, because hardness with the kind of accuracy that we have, hardness does not give it to you. And the point here that I would just like to add, and I know that you're not interested too much in the problem in the Congress as far as this, because we should make our decisions on the basis of
strategic
reality.
Is credibility to what the Congress will pass.
The NCA defense, the defense of the capital area, would be approved by the Congress, I am convinced. Now, we have some people that would object to it in the Foreign Relations Committee and some committees like that won't support us anyway. But in the committees that I deal with, the Appropriations Committee,
and the Armed Services Committee, we would have a very strong vote for that, provided it is a part of the SALT agreement. Now, if it isn't a part of the SALT agreement, then there, that will be the last site that's built in our 12-site program, I hope so. It can be approved if it's part of this agreement, but it cannot be, it'll be the last of the 12 sites built, I think, if it isn't a part of this agreement.
So are you saying, what about the argument that's been made that you really can't compare Washington to Moscow because of what Moscow defends? Moscow defends a lot more than NCAA does.
That is correct. They also test certain strategic coverage in Washington and their industrial complex.
And Washington is also very strong.
Well,
let's put it this way. When you say Moscow and Washington, it's two for them and one for us. Put it in this.
They get a double payoff on the Moscow.
So we just can't put it up. I understand there may be some places where we get us the other way, but let's not get our illusions if that's an even trade.
Right. Well, I agree with that.
Mr. President, may I make an announcement?
Yes, sure.
For the figures I have seen communication, you've got a Washington-Moscow trade-off that would be substantial additional population that would be protected by Washington and would be protected by Moscow. And I think you ought to compensate that factor against this factor that Moscow defends some ICBM. I think you also ought to keep in mind that in the range of interceptors that we're talking about here, 100 interceptors, the fact that theoretically they can fly out and protect ICBMs is not a very real advantage, because 100 interceptors to protect the Moscow plus ICBMs is nonsense.
What does population have to do with who strikes first?
Well, I think the figment...
Let's just talk about that one question. They have a first strike, they strike first. Population only?
Yes, sir, because the more population of a nation can protect, presumably the greater temptation there would be to strike first, and that's why we're trying to avoid systems that have or have the potential to protect large parts of your population.
We're not going to strike first. No, I think you put yourself in their position. I mean, it's just a lot of them. I mean, the point that they're concerned is with Moscow, they're protecting something that's far more important to them than population.
I think, as Mel pointed out, the main interest of the Soviets protecting Moscow is not against an American first strike. It's against some sort of a looming Chinese attack. Because they know that Moscow is not going to help at all against an American strike.
So I'd say that I think if there were an exchange, protecting more of the population might turn out to be a hindrance rather than a help, because if you have any more people.
Mr. President, I would just like to, we have really conducted some very good studies on the Marshall missile site defense, and we are going through the Congress with it. We've got the full funding on this contract. We just went forward with it. It's a major contract, just like we went forward with the contract evaluation. I briefed all members of the Congress on both of the committees. They wanted to go ahead. We signed the contract just 2 weeks ago. I do not look for any difficulty there. We have people like some of our critics that were rather critical of the safeguard program are very much in support of our going forward with the Hartsack program. But you see, one of the problems was getting safeguard was that you had to, in order to defend safeguard, you have to be for all 12 sites.
Yeah.
And the talk and the discussions were that this could be overwhelmed by the Soviet Union. Now, in our studies on the hard side, point defense, all of our studies show that we can defend from 200 to 300 missiles.
Jerry, do I understand that that decision is not negotiable? You haven't talked about hard side at all?
No, sir. You have never mentioned
it. You haven't read, mentioned it because it isn't... when you didn't say it's not negotiable, I meant it. You haven't negotiated at this point.
We haven't even mentioned this to our allies or to Congress in the SALT context. And it seems to me, with due respect to Mel, that if we went up with a SALT treaty that says connected with this is an appropriation for an entirely new ABM system costing billions of dollars, I think that it would have a very large effect on the ratification process of that SALT treaty to call for a thing
with ABM. What's your answer to that, Mel?
Jerry, I just want you to know that I admit that that's the way I sold the system, that we might be cut down from a 12-site program to a smaller program and a smaller site, and that's the way I sold the program. That's the way I got the money for it.
Let me, could I give it to Paul? Paul, you have a view.
I
know you have a view, but you might have to press the question to go to the
Soviets, not as part of their formal statements, but as part of the informal. Searching and exploration of what kind of common ground might we find between their non-negotiable 201 and our non-negotiable 201. They are the ones that have come forward with the idea of 242, one of those two sites, to be a hard site ICBM defense on both sides, is the ground where one can find a compromise. Now there are some things which still need to be negotiated, and that is the precise definition of the quantitative response. The other is the provision with respect to the number of interceptors involved on both sides. Because they have talked about the lower number of interceptors that would be necessary for a meaningful defense. Those are the only two areas of negotiation that appear. I think any other proposal it would be much more now. Here's Jerry and I disagree.
Mr. President, I don't quite understand the disagreement. You go ahead, Jerry.
Mr. President, we have been talking to the Soviets for 2.5 years ago about level fighting.
Very much.
Like 200 interceptors. The purpose of these talks is to limit ADF. The Soviets, within the last 6 months, have reduced the number of interceptors for two sites from 300 to 150. Now, if we go back to them and say, look, we'd like to have you consider something that might call for 1,000, 2,000, or 3,000 interceptors and an unlimited number of radars, it seems to me if it is negotiable, it's going to be negotiable 2 or 3 years from now, not now, because it's an entirely different approach to arms control, to build up arms instead of reducing.
Except for that. I mean, what's your argument on this here?
Their proposal is that the number of radars, for instance, be unlimited within a specified circle length, that's just one ICBM field. Couldn't have them outside in that field. And they also indicated that they agreed that that be outside of the Soviet Union, outside of the European part of the Soviet Union. So that they think that an unlimited number of radars, provided they are qualitatively constrained and are geographically limited to one small place in an undangerous part of the country, that this is not dangerous from the possibility of base that could cover the country, and that this is the thing to do. With respect to the number of interceptors,
Jerry's quite right.
They had proposed 300 interceptors on both sides. I think their last informal words were that they thought the best solution would be somewhere between 150 and 200. I think the reason they've done that is that we have been pressing on and keep the number of interceptors as low as possible. And I don't think that they wanted to get outflanked on that issue by themselves being in a position of recommending more. Now, I'm not at all sure that we wouldn't have trouble with the unlimited number of interceptors. But I'm not sure that we would. And particularly, the OSD proposal is not that we go in now and say we want to have a large number of entries. The OSD proposal is that during the next 3 years, while we're negotiating, if following outlines have been written, during that period, we negotiate a number of interceptions for this group. So that at that time, we will know better what kind of thing we can foresee and treat, the offers and treat. So we know whether there's a real limitation on the trail, whether there is. If there isn't a real limitation on the trail, then the explanation is for years we wouldn't be free to go forward with large. If there is a real limitation on the offers, then perhaps we wouldn't need any of the
You want to go to summer? We'll come back to this in a minute. On that basis, between 41 and
1975 becomes, would at least force them not only to stop production, to stop laying new keels, but it would force them to stop constructing on submarines on which they have already, on which they're already working. They are producing submarines at the rate of about 8 a year. We are not producing any at the moment. We have the OMS program, but the first OMS will not be completed until 1978. And we are then building up to what, about 5 a year, about 18 minutes.
We do not get,
Bringing them up to something like 60. increase the conversion of old settlement for new. I think the judgment is that without these additions to our proposals, it will be very hard to get an SLBM, to get an SLBM adopted. The major problem and the major incentive that we have to get an SLBM, get the SLBMs into the treatment is, if SLBMs remain unconstrained, as I understand, the Soviets can continue to build 80 years. And there's nothing we can do until 1978 to catch up. I talked informally to Tom about possibility of a crash program, at least to put some pressure on
the fight erupt and what can be found. I suggested, but why can't we finish? Why is it here?
Well, if we continued all our other programs, our other programs, I mean, the CCD, submarine, and the other nuclear work, we probably could construct, as I know, three or four of the 640 class, which is the type of submarine we have today. These submarines, of course, would have the old technology, and it would take additional resources for them. Then there's a possibility that of converting the conventional submarine, but that would be also very expensive and would certainly interfere with the other.
Well, looking at it in terms of the reason we asked the question, we're just looking at it in terms of you don't get a deal. On a crash program, what do you come out with?
Well, so I would recommend you to
pick that. I understand how it'd be costly and the rest, but what could you do? You could do better than 78.
Yeah, so what you could do is from instead of, as I say, three without interfering with the ongoing health program, you could probably go up to around 10 if you were willing to assign the priorities and interfere with the other systems. But we wouldn't recommend that, sir. Yeah, the current plan.
What would you recommend?
I recommend, sir, that we decide that we accelerate the development program.
And again, by acceleration of all programs, you get some.
Well, sir, then rather than having, like a 1-3-3-3 program, which the Secretary of Defense mentioned, you could,
that's what's been approved.
That's what's been approved, right? You could go from laying fields about one in the first quarter 74, then the next year 4, and the next year 8. Make you a nine. I think that the important thing here is that it's publicly known that we are moving out with a new program. That's really more important than having a specific IOC date. Yes, sir. So there's a political meeting.
Well, I said also through thinking about this, and I'm forward to it totally, so I'm not, I guess, but isn't it true that because we're moving our design, we're going to be ahead of them in actual facts, strategically?
Well, if you're going to balance the submarine for a submarine, that's true.
Well, I mean, we're way ahead because we have, what, we have 10 warheads on each side?
That's right.
So that's 160 that we have, and what do they have? They have 16 in the white class.
Yeah, they have 16.
So we're way ahead of them, and we will be in that field for, what, until 1978 or so?
Well, I think that they will not probably, they will have a case that, they have the technology now. I think the first time they could deploy it, the multiple warheads would be probably in 24 months on those submarines. It would be 24 months from now that they could probably deploy the multiple warheads.
But the point here is to say that that's moving, do it. We think it's just multiple.
Well, I don't get into those discussions as to how their track system works because we know that they can change their pattern. Whether we've now seen them using stellar inertial guidance on their large missile, and this argument as to how the bus system, whether they have their own computer in their bus or whether they have just a track system, I just don't think that makes any difference. We know they can throw multiple warheads at us, but we know that they have accuracy. The point here, Mr. President, is militarily, I'm not concerned about them having 51 submarines. We're having 41. As long as we have an ongoing program. The problem that concerns me is not from the military standpoint, it's what our allies and our friends are going to think on down the years if we get up, if say they get up to 70 and we're still at the 41 mark
without our program.
Without a program coming along. And so I don't think the number argument by itself, I can go out and defend that all over the United States and in our country.
secure, is as long as we have an ongoing program coming along so our lives are crisp, and particularly the people here in the United States, know we have an ongoing program moving forward. So the number business, although it's important in the minds of some, I think we can keep that technological superiority so we can continue to move out and have a better system of delivery than they do.
There's no disagreement at all on this point, I think, as far as we know we're all.
But I think to build Chinese copies of old submarines is really something that we ought to give some consideration to, because I think that would be kind of a mistake for us to go and not use the technology that we have as far as refining and some of these other things that give us increased capability. And when I talk to our NATO allies and others, they understand that our submarine technology is better than theirs. And this is an important thing to stress too, our technological advantage in this area.
We have two problems with respect to building if submarines are concerned. One is what the relative position would be if there's no follow-on agreement. The second is what the relative position would be if there is a follow-on agreement. If we move at a very leisurely pace, then, but if there's no follow-on agreement, then we will have the situation that Tom and others have described, in which they may have 70 submarines and we have 41. And that visually, no matter how we explain, isn't going to look good to unsophisticated people. But supposing there is a follow-on agreement, the danger is, there will be follow-on negotiations, the danger is that they will lay the keel quite free of 16 more than proposed agreement. And then, if we have moved along in at a leisurely pace until that point, we'll be in great difficulty. And therefore, if for any reason the SLPMs do not prove to be negotiable, then we ought to give some consideration to how we can at least show some activity that will bring pressure on them to have a quicker follow-on agreement, or that will give us higher numbers if there is a three. Otherwise, they won't have any pressure on them until 75 on this program. They can look into well into 74 with only one key left.
Well, yes, we come to the point. Jerry, what about us? I understand that's out of ballpark, right?
I don't think so, Mr. President. I think that we have made a dent.
Was before, but maybe it's changed.
Well, I think we argued this case more powerfully than we thought we were going to. We hammered on this more than any other subject at Vienna. There is an indication that as a result of that, they are restudying the question. And I think it is much too soon to rule out some form of inclusion of VSLs in the freedoms.
Mr. President, on that point, I think that they have had the impression that we're going to succeed on this point.
I agree. Remember, Bill, at our previous meeting, he said, well, look, you can't agree to this, because it's going to, they're going to agree to something that's going to put them into a position of superiority where we're pretty much ahead. This is something they were moving on, but go ahead.
Well, I think as Jerry does, that we ought to press hard to this. I think it's going to be very difficult to justify an agreement we don't have. And certainly, I think maybe action by you highest level before we get to Moscow might help. I think it's going to be very difficult to justify this if it looks now as if they stopped their deployment of ICBMs at least at the moment, and they've got a laser program and a submarine killer. And we don't have one at the moment, it's going to look as if we've agreed to let them go ahead in a major way in the program that they have underway, and we don't have one underway.
So I think Mel's point is very important that he made first, that maybe it looks as if they've stopped the ICBMs, but we've seen time and again in the past where there were these pauses. Therefore, to get international zealot on the ICBMs is going to be very important.
Well, I was not against that. I agree with that. But I think then if you leave open the SOBM question so that they can proceed at an accelerated pace and turn out 80 days a year, if I were standing still, it's going to be very difficult to justify, wouldn't we? And certainly it's going to be difficult to get an application, and people are going to say, well, he fell into a trap. And I think that certainly we ought to make a major effort to include them, and I think maybe for one reason or another, they decided that up until the last meeting, they decided that we probably wouldn't have found an answer to give on this. And I think we should put them in, too, that we're not going to give.
Mr. President, one thing that bothers me is if we, in making an agreement of limiting numbers, if we make that agreement based on our present technological superiority, and if the agreement provides for modernization and conversion of their units, the minute there's a limitation of numbers, they can then turn all their resources to their technology. And there's no reason to think, based on their past performance, that their technology is not going to sometime catch up with theirs. I don't think we can assume we're always going to be ahead of them technologically, particularly if the pressure is taken off of them in the construction. So I think we have to be extremely careful that we don't negotiate ourselves in a position where we have a good agreement at the time it's made that subsequently becomes a very bad agreement.
Mr. President, as you know, throughout the discussion, back to the defensive systems, where we had an ongoing program and we delayed it, or have restrained, or have at least discussed the possibility of restraining it, while in the meantime, they continued with their ongoing programs. And I think that in the discussion of the offensive agreement, we should insist on equivalency with equal zeal that they've insisted on equivalency with the defensive system. Otherwise, we're going to end up here with one and a half or twice as many ICBMs and twice as many submarines. And from a political point of view, or Kennedy's point of view, if that gets to be generally known, I think it puts us in a great disadvantage because the average person is not going to be able to evaluate in terms of accuracy and merits and all these technical details. He just knows that two is bigger than one. And that's really our problem, I see. It's getting some kind of an equivalency that we can rationalize before the Congress and before the public.
Of course, the decisions we may have to make, not at this meeting, is whether we'd rather not have this treatment or this treatment, and whether we are better off leaving the whole thing on first try, including ICBMs, especially as you pointed out that expression of the whether we are putting more pressure on them by letting the race continue. When we can't race for a number of years, according to your own figures, or whether we should limit what we can limit and the ICBMs, and then race in the one category, in the only category in which we have a program anyway. All the more so, as much of this sweetening is in the proposal, will have the practical consequence of giving them a two years more production. And that gets to the point of duration, Mr. President, because
before you leave together, look at the SLBMs. Of course, you don't have to decide that much, but let's take a look down our throats here in terms of not what we say we can do, but what they know we might be able to do because of our political situation. You put your finger on it. We all know that in terms of ICBMs and the rest, we have a very, very difficult time, you know, going on a big program to build a hell of a lot more. We don't even have a missile. I know, but I mean, we haven't had any new ones in a long time. But the second point is that in terms of suffering, this is an area where it is credible for us to say, now this also should help the negotiating side in the event that it's negotiable. But assuming for the moment that you couldn't negotiate, that you can't get it, we won't be sorry. In any event, you try. We have to remember that in the ICBM field, in the land-based missile field, this is the place where it is imperative, if we can, to get a deal. Because no matter how much we talk about, well, we'll get going, we'll start something new and so forth, we are going to be able to produce, and they know it. On the other hand, the submarine field,
it's also in our interest to have a deal, for the reasons we mentioned. But on the other hand, it is an area where we can move forward and where we can get congressional support. I've oversimplified it, because some would say, oh, well, if the people know that the Soviet Union won't make an agreement, then anybody can go before the American people and say, we're going to be sure we don't fall behind in any deal and so forth. But just looking at the realities, submarines, in terms of what you can do in the Congress, are a lot easier than ICBM. Would you agree with that question?
We had, this update, there's a tremendous support. We had good support there. I mean, we've got presidential candidates who never thought of kind of budget that he's still out for our submarine program, making speeches for it. We got Muskie making speeches for it. Yeah, they're all for submarines. They're not correct. A lot of other discussions.
In fact, Mr. President, if on all these cultures and modernization options, you have a real time problem. As I understand it, clearly, under a freeze, we will continue to lay key in saying that's modernization.
Yeah.
And that means we can fill these things for 3 years until the missiles are actually put in before we scrap anything over. Supposing the Soviets continue building, start laying keels of that 25-foot longer submarine and say, well, these eight we are putting in a year now for modernization, they're not within the freeze, and as soon as they are far enough along, we may take out some other one.
So, I think they probably are laying a keel on this.
Well, I say the freeze on submarines, unless it stops laying keels when we really think about it. The treasures may look like a total phony because we build lay keels claiming it's for modernization farm, but in fact it could be in addition to the 41. They can continue to lay the 25-foot longer keel or whatever modification they want to do and say, well, we're doing that for modernization and in 2 years we may retire. Some benefit agreement is of a relatively short duration. We will never know. We will not have achieved what we want, which is to interrupt their construction. If we can interrupt their construction program, the freeze won't do us a hell of a lot of good. And that is the measure. This is in favor, this is what its duration either to be long. And then we still have to make a decision which we hadn't addressed yet, whether it should prohibit the laying of steel.
Go on with duration.
Well, the issue of duration, I've just now put. There's a strong argument to be made, which the chiefs made, for a relatively short duration, which is that a short duration puts the maximum on offensive weapons. A short duration puts the maximum pressure on them, because the offensive freeze would then end. And because there is presumably going to be some clause that links the end of the offensive freeze to the possibility, at least, of abrogating the defensive agreement. On the other hand, one has to, on the other side, the probability of that exercising pressure has to be seen in terms of their assessment of the likelihood that we would in fact abrogate the ABM agreement. And that at that point, we will be in a better position than they raised in ABM performance. The one consequence of the ABM treaty will be that it will interrupt our program. And therefore gives them the time to catch up in tooling up once they've completed their testing. So it is not a foregone conclusion that at the end of the offensive freeze, that we would either abrogate the agreement or we will be in a better position than they to raise. The second pressure we could have is that we will start racing on offensive. On offensive. Again, this depends on the judgment who is going to be in a better position to raise at that point. That would depend on they tooled up better during an offensive freeze. And who can go into production more rapidly. Again, my judgment isn't decisive here, but one could argue that the shorter the freeze, the less the interruption in their submarine program. And it has to be entered the program. And secondly, the easier it will be for them to stay tooled up in
debt will be easier to be for them to start raising. So that while everyone who's addressed this issue of duration has come up with a split, with a schizophrenia on it, there's strong arguments to be made for the short duration in terms of the pressure. But then when you analyze the pressure, you're not absolutely sure that they really work in our favor. And with respect to the submarines, if you add all these sweetness to it, they could lay keels within the permitted limits for 2 years, and if that agreement is 2.5 years, we have only had a cosmetic dream. So Council tend to lean towards the proposition that if submarines are included, the duration of the offensive freeze should be on the longer side.
Bill, what you've heard, I agree with Henry on the last point. If submarines are included, then I think it ought to be longer. If submarines are not included, then I think it should be considerably shorter. I would like to spread to go back to the point I raised before, and that is, I think we should make a major effort to convince the Russians we're serious about having submarines included. I think they're under the impression that we're probably prepared to give on it. Now, maybe we'll have to, maybe we'll decide that, but it seems to me in the meantime, the delegation should go back and be in a position to bargain very well on this issue. I think it's going to be, I think that the agreement, although I agree with the logic of an ICBM agreement with the absence of the institution of submarine, I think it's going to seem to be a very much more doubtful proposition if we leave the submarine race alive. So I think we should make a very serious effort, and I think the words should be let out. I think you'll have to make the decision long before you get the mask. I don't think this is one of the things you should decide then. But somehow we've got to get the word that the Russians were serious about this, and they're interested in limiting offensive weapons. And they are now up with us. We're about equal. They should be willing to put a ceiling on submarines. And it seems to me we're in a very disadvantaged position there. This program that they have underway that's going so speedily is continued while we're getting ready for the onshore campaign, which is not going to be ready for a while. So I'm not suggesting what the final decision should be that you have to make, but I think in the meantime we should make a very tough, take a very tough stand on this.
Mr. President, I think what we really want, finally, is an action in total, if we really are for arms and safety. But I agree with the Secretary of State that you cannot get them to agree to SLBM freeze, this period that we're going to hold this forthcoming discussion should be short. And if they do, then we can continue to try to refine it and come up with a final offensive treaty, which again, as I say, emphasizes the principle of equivalency.
Overall.
I don't think that she said any disagreement with what the Secretary of State
said. No, that's good. That's good. No, that's much. That would be covered by the duration. You say it depends on whether
it's included.
Yeah, sure.
Anybody else want to talk about the Secretary? Sure, better not make that explicit, because if we tell the Russians that his submarines are included, the three sessions are longer, since they want the short threes, we give them another argument against including submarines.
No, we wouldn't have thought.
Well, Mr. President, it seems to me that now is the time that we will have greater bargaining position, a stronger bargaining position before we go on this ABM thing than any other time. So that's why I think it's so important that we keep the pressure on now on the submarine launch missile, because our biggest, strongest position is now before we make the ABM agreement.
Mr. President, I think also we have to keep in mind that I think the Russians think because of the visit that we're under a great deal of pressure to include this agreement, therefore our negotiating position is kind of eroded. The other day when I testified, I was then appointed license committee. I attempted to point out that we'd like to have an agreement when we went to Moscow, but that we were also might be during the year sometime. Well, I think if they have a feeling that we're just panning for an agreement before we get to Moscow, and Jerry's and the job is going to be much more difficult. But I'd say one other thing before we get, I've gone over the treaty pretty carefully, the draft treaty, and I think because we have these discussions, we sometimes tend to forget the excellent job these negotiators have done, that the language of the treaty is really excellent, and they've done a hell of a job, and they deserve real credit, and I think that we all should express that to them.
Yes.
That's right. The language itself, or that they negotiated, is really superb. Done much of a job, and a lot of the things that they've settled already will not even come up here because they've done such a good job, including it in the treaty. And if we can get an agreement to you, and the public sees this treaty, I think it would be very impressive.
Each has the same translation.
Yes, the real law. I'm trying to get the correct text.
There will be a first in this
administration. Yeah, well, I know. We know.
One of the best teams
hard to realize.
One of the best teams I've ever had.
One of the things about the team, okay.
I want to say this already on that subject is that it's one too that that expression's never quite so new. I mean, Paul Banks is inside a few years and so forth, so on to be I'll read the sad point of course that being placed.
Arizona. It's true, and I'm all about a YouTube and all of this. Well, I think we've got a, this has been a very helpful discussion, and I'm sure you know that we're all in the country. Make the best possible deal if you can here. I'm glad to have the Texas Republican representative on our side. This problem of the submarine and so forth. And we also have to acknowledge that we have to have a agreement. It's very important to if the other side thinks that you have to have one, it's their base. Because they may want one. Maybe we do too. The other side, and it is desirable to have one. And and it may be that this is the time to achieve it. Just spending one moment on that, on the matter of agreement. This is something we would not want them to involve. I say we would want them to know. If they're smart enough to know, and I must say that you go abroad and find that our friends, particularly the totalitarian world, are very, very sensitive about what is feasible, what can be done in this area. We look at an arms control agreement with all the problems of possibility of cheating and all the possibilities of whether it's going to be one that is going to that feels far too concerned. We have to realize and recognize pretty tough facts that they are moving very, very substantially. And our moving is very substantially inhibited. It will continue to be inhibited. While a case can be made, you can scare the American people to death, and it may become necessary at some point. If you don't get an agreement and say, look, they're going out, and we're going to go all out. But on the other hand, we have to realize that at the present time, on that score, when they're moving ahead at a very, very great pace, I know it can be said, sure, we're doing those, and we've got the targeting system, MIRV, and all the rest. We have some advantages. We're not all that far behind, particularly the technological field. I know all those things. But if you look at that in terms of what a totalitarian power like the Soviet Union that wants to be ahead and to be ahead not for the purpose of fighting the war, but be ahead for the purpose of influencing the world, they have a lot more movement than we have, a lot more ability to bolster their inhibitors, maybe to the fact that they'd like to put more of their GNP into consumer goods, so forth and so on. But they're not concerned about the damage of peace to the world. They're not concerned. They don't need to be. They're not concerned about an image of peace with their own people. They aren't concerned about things that have to motivate us. And so under these circumstances, therefore, the arguments for agreement become rather strong. And agreement now, speaking to that point, just leaving it there, everybody has made it better. I think we have to realize that the American position, insofar as our relative to the Soviet Union, has steadily eroded since 1961 or 2, right?
That's correct.
It's gone down and down, and they've gone up and up. And it is not something to run to the hills about, but it's something to recognize that the American position, as it arose, that situation isn't going to change very much. The only new weapon system that we have initiated, and we did it with one vote in the Senate, it was ABM in the last 10 years. And with our public opinion, what it is, et cetera, they know this just probably even better than some of our own people do. We have quite a problem. Therefore, insofar as an arms control agreement, our bargaining position may be better now than later. It may be better now than later because, insofar as this may be the last time that the United States can look at them in a relatively even position. As time goes on, then of course it'll be, they'll want to keep us, we'll be in a position where we won't want to keep them because they'll be ahead. This is another way to look at it. Now, having said that, it doesn't mean that our negotiators go back and say, hey, we've got to have an agreement now, at all costs, and so forth. Let's just put it in this context. We don't have to have an agreement because we're going to Moscow. That isn't the reason. We've got to put this on the basis of a national interest. We've got to look at it. And that's the way we've been studying for 2.5 years in terms of whether in view of an arms race in which they're moving and we are not, or at least not moving as fast, whether it is now not in our national interest to see if we cannot have some limitation. We believe it is. That's why we went into these negotiations. So we're trying to get a limitation. That will be the beginning, beginning on both sides to look into the future of halting this escalation in a race that nobody is going to be allowed to win. We can never let them get this nasty superiority. It's going to be much more difficult for us to gin up the support for it for political reasons that I mentioned. But we can never allow that. And by the same token, the Soviet Union is never going to allow the United States to be in the position we were at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's what we face. And so these things are what brings these the things that bring us together. But we make the best deal we possibly can, hoping that is what we can let that dispel the American people. Well, we'll work this out. Better to get my camera out. I was mad.